In July of last year, EPA held its National Association of Remedial Project Managers meeting in Portland, Oregon, and one of the most attended sessions was on green remediation. Because of its success, members of the EPA, led by the Engineering Forum, have taken this full-day session and are bringing back a number of the same talks as online seminars this winter. This is the final of the three sessions. EPA's definition of green remediation includes the practice of considering the environmental effects of a remediation strategy, that is, the remedy selected and the implementation approach early in the process and incorporating options to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup action. Some practices are quite mature, such as construction site best management practices, including stormwater runoff management and construction and demolition debris recycling. Others are still emerging, including the use of renewable energy sources such as wind and solar to remedial systems. Over the three sessions, you to the key technical policy and application aspects of green remediation. Before I turn it over to the first of our three speakers, I remind phone participants to please put your phone on mute. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, please hit *6 now on hold. Today's first speaker is an emergency response, which is also known as OSWR, in Washington, D.C. She joined EPA's headquarters office from the Pacific Southwest Regional Office in San Francisco, California, where she was a Superfund project manager responsible for leading and overseeing environmental remediation efforts at several National Priority List or NPL sites in California. In addition, Penny led the development of the Cleanup Clean Air Initiative, a regional initiative with an facilitate and support diesel emissions and greenhouse gas reduction technologies and practices at Superfund cleanup and redevelopment sites. Penny has also spent time in the EPA's Air Division working on voluntary measures related to diesel emission reductions under the framework of the National Clean Diesel Campaign. Most recently, she led the development of OSWR's new initiative, Renewable Energy Powering America's Land, Renewable Energy on Contaminated Lands and Mining Sites, which encourages, facilitates, and supports the development of renewable energy facilities on EPA tract sites such as Superfund, RCRA, brownfields, and mining sites across the country. Penny has been with the US EPA for over 10 years and holds a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Science and a Master of Science in Environmental Resources Management from the University of San Francisco. Welcome, Penny.
Thank you, Raji. Hopefully everybody can hear me okay, and good morning to those of you on the West Coast and elsewhere, and good afternoon to everybody on the East. By just giving you a little bit of a warning, I don't have internet access, so I'm going to be flipping through my slides on my computer. Our internet connection is down at the moment. So hopefully I'll be on the right slide, and perhaps, Raji, you can help me if I'm off a little bit. So just to begin with, I'm planning on giving a very similar talk as I did at the National Association of Remedial Project Managers meeting this past last year, and I'm going to focus on the green remediation concepts and some of the tools that have been cleaning up contaminated sites. And so the first slide, and you can see I'm still not used to the date of being 2009, that 2008 should be a 9. So the next slide, I just wanted to, again, give an overview of some of the available tools, and those include a covering of the renewable energy mapping, so renewable energy on contaminated lands mapping, the green remediation contract toolkit, a little bit of an update on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Memorandum of Understanding and the language that was incorporated there, and we will move on to the next slide. Actually, if you just advance forward to the fourth slide, I will be, I think it's fair to say that EPA is kind of taking this multi-prong approach to green remediation in general, and that is where, as with calls like this and with multiple other conference venues, we are doing a lot of outreach and education to our internal and external partners and stakeholders, coordinating with all the interested parties, and identifying work, identifying and working on pilot sites for green remediation, and of course measuring the results of those projects. So forwarding on to the next slide. So I'm going to start with the Green Remediation Contract Toolkit, which was developed really out of my colleague's office and his great efforts there. And I'm just going to go over very briefly what this is. Its intent is to be a quick reference guide to determine kind of where along the contract execution process you can add in language for innovative approaches, green remediation, renewable energy development, and things like that all along the contract procurement process, execution and procurement process. It says here a guide for EPA staff, which it is, but it's also for anybody who is working on contract development for remedial action sites. So clean. Anybody at the states or anything through this, they can also tap into this tool as a guide on different places along the way that language can be added in. So the idea is to provide this type of green remediation contract toolkit for all of the types of contracts that EPA manages, and we started with the first one that's in bold there. It's the remedial action contract, the RAC contract, which has been completed and is online, and I'll go over that in just a moment. We're now working on working through the development of this toolkit for the other types of contracts that we have: the emergency and rapid response, the START contract, the ESAT, the REPA, et cetera. You can read through that. And the next slide, the audience, again, it's RPMs, on-scene coordinators, contracting and project officers who are involved in support of the removal actions, remedial response, and support services. And again, this could be within EPA as well as outside of EPA. And the next slide just gives an outline of the areas that we looked at. So this is it's basically a matrix showing the remedial action contract, the RAC contract process, and where you can insert language into the contract along the process. The pre-award. That's okay. Thank you.
Sorry.
It starts with a, excuse me. Starts with the pre-award phase through the planning and procurement process, so the very beginning process, and establishes through the contract type, so when you're actually establishing what kind of contract it's going to be, through the writing of the statement of work and where in that process you can add language, which is really key. That's a key step. And establishing the contract terms and conditions, and when you're establishing evaluation criteria and selection criteria for the contractors. We also look at the contract performance side of things. So in writing the work assignment and the task orders, as well as so the general kind of categories of consideration in within the work assignment and task orders, and then the RIFS, the remedial investigation and feasibility study phase, the remedial design and remedial action phase, and the operation and maintenance phase. And then on down the line from, reviewing and approving the work plans, evaluating the performance, and then recognition of contractor performance. So on to the next slide. This is very hard to read, I'm sure, on your slide. This is online, and I'll provide the website in just a moment, but this is just to give you an idea of what the matrix looks like. So here you can see the pre-award activities, planning and procurement, the contract type, the statement of work, and you can see kind of where the potential opportunity is for including language that's includes innovative and green remediation, as well as who kind of to work with along the process at each step, who to work with in the contracting process, and then some of the expected outcomes and results. So the next three slides, kind of outline, give you a snapshot of what this matrix looks like. And I don't have this on the slide, but it is on the CLUIN website. It's the www.greenremediation.com. And it's under the contract RAC contract toolkit. So if you just go to the Green Remediation website, you'll be able to pull that up. In its final form, what you're seeing here is not a final form. So the next slide, kind of the next steps on the contract toolkit. I say finalized contract toolkit for RAC. That's been done. And continue to develop the tools that I listed earlier. And then, of course, to continue outreach and training on how to actually use the toolkit where necessary. And the next thing I wanted to cover was the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the EPA renegotiated last year the Memorandum of Understanding that's been in place for a long time. And we're able to include some language that would allow for use of green technologies, green remediation type of technologies and practices under that Memorandum of Understanding. Any work that's done by U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for EPA can include those types of technologies and practices. So, and I included the language there for you to read. And then moving on to the next slide, let me just make sure I cover everything. Yeah, moving on to the next slide, just wanted to go over the, as Raji said, there's a new initiative in OSWER. It's the Repowering America's Land, Siting Renewable Energy on Contaminated Land and Mining Sites. And the goal, as she had mentioned, is to encourage and support and facilitate development of renewable energy production facilities on contaminated lands and mining sites, including RCRA, the Superfund sites, the brownfield sites, the abandoned mine sites, and to some extent active mining sites if we can. And it basically focuses on just what it says, developing renewable where redevelopment of land could be with renewable energy production facilities. And the next slide, just wanted to go over just quickly some of the benefits, and then I'll get into the mapping tool. What we did, let me just back up real quick, what we did is we mapped out all of what we call EPA track lands. These are all lands that EPA is involved in on some level. And we matched them against renewable energy generation potential. Sorry, there's a bit of background noise. Okay. Raji, I just want to check in. Is everything coming through okay?
Yes, it is.
Great, thank you. I just didn't want to lose anybody. Okay, what we did is we matched these lands and screened them using screening criteria we developed with the National Renewable Energy Lab to determine on a very kind of high-level screening which sites that we track qualify for what type of renewable energy. And we looked at wind, solar, concentrated solar power, and we looked at the Stirling engine systems as well as the trough and power tower systems, photovoltaics, and we looked at biopower, specifically bio renewable energy production, so actually production of electricity from biofuels, or excuse me, from biomass, and then biorefining facilities, so places we could potentially site biorefining and focusing on cellulosic cells. And so we matched all of our sites where they matched anything at all, and we mapped those out and provided that on a mapping tool. And just to back up to go over some of those benefits, there are thousands of acres of land that EPA tracks. The figures seem to jump around a bit, but it's somewhere in the range of 15 million acres that we track across the country. Infrastructure like lines, roads, railway for access. Approximately 80%, I think I'll get into some of the numbers in just a minute, but approximately 80% of the sites that we track are in what we call non-urban or rural areas. So there is the potential to kind of avoid, if you will, NIMBY issues that are often associated with, you know, big wind turbines and perhaps large solar fields and things of that nature. And many of these sites are already zoned for this type of use for an industrial, when we're talking about some of the mining sites, for example. So the other thing that some of the benefits are that it provides an economic value for property that otherwise might lack, you know, significant redevelopment value. Or, for example, if you are looking at a site that's a very remote, rural, it may not be considered for, you know, your traditional kind of redevelopment, housing, commercial, businesses and things like that. So we see this as a viable economic redevelopment, providing economic redevelopment value. And it may, we're looking into this now into kind of more of the numbers, the cost-benefit analysis, provide lower overall transaction costs compared to development of these same facilities on green fields. But again, we're looking into studying that a little bit in more depth right now. So perhaps at the next call or presentation, I'll have more to share on that. And importantly, here it reduces the stress on our green fields, on our undeveloped lands, on our pristine land that we want to try to leave intact if we can. So we see this as a great way to develop something that's sustainable and green. After we clean up a site or when we get it to the point of being ready for reuse, that this is a, you know, a great green redevelopment, and we get to preserve green space at the same time. And then, of course, the obvious, it provides clean, emission-free energy for either on-site use, so as in many cases of green remediation, practices may use solar or wind or microturbines, for example. You'll see an example of that for hydro microturbines for treating contamination on site or running the systems, the pumps, and things like that on site, on a cleanup site. Can be used locally if it's a little bit larger scale. Can be used locally in a town that may be nearby, or even at a facility if there's, or in some cases there are schools and universities that are located nearby, for example, like landfills, and they can pipe off the landfill gas and convert that into electricity for their use at a specific facility. Or, of course, on a much larger scale, on a utility scale, can be put into the next slide. I went over most of this already. 15, 16 million acres, depending. Again, about 80% are non-urban of our lands or tract lands are non-urban, which and 20% of those are abandoned mine lands, which is mine lands are not always, but they can be very large in acreage, and that's really important for siting large-scale renewable energy. You need a lot of land for commercial utility scale. And as we're moving on into a new administration, we're hearing a lot about green jobs and kind of this economic stimulus that's gone through kind of green jobs, renewable energy, and we do see this as a great opportunity for to kind of reintroduce that may have actually lost jobs in the past when operations closed down at mining sites, at refining sites and things like that, industrial facilities. So it's a good way to kind of reintroduce some of those local jobs and have them kind of fit into the direction, it seems like, at least, that we're going. The next slide, I apologize, that's a duplicate, so one more slide. And this is just to really demonstrate the potential. I'm not going to go into a lot of the detail here, but if we developed solar energy on our EPA track lands, this is approximately the megawatt potential, and it far exceeds what the projections are for PV and thermal, solar PV and thermal capacity, and likewise with the wind energy potential if we developed our EPA track lands. This is the amount we could get and a capacity is going to be. The next slide just gives you a little bit more of the background. It was a joint EPA National Renewable Energy Lab venture. We have uploaded them onto a Google Earth mapping application, so it's interactive and hopefully useful. And we developed about 170 state-specific maps. Those are available also online, and I'll go through a little bit of where you can find some of these maps in just a moment. And then we provided incentive sheets that provide financial incentives for every state to develop renewable energy on a variety of scales as well, not just large scale. And then also for every state, we developed incentive sheets that outline what are the contaminated land redevelopment incentives. So we kind of married the two into one fact sheet so that if somebody's interested in redeveloping or including renewable energy in a contaminated site, they can potentially reap the incentives of two different program areas. The next slide just goes into the Google Earth mapping tool. This is the audience, everybody who's interested here. The next slide just gives a brief overview of what I already talked about. These are the types of renewable energy sources we screened. I'll get into some of what we're looking at for next steps after criteria are on the right-hand side under the preliminary screening criteria. So again, looking at availability of a renewable energy resource, of course, the acreage of the land, the distance to transmission lines, as well as the graded roads and rail, slope and aspect of the property. And the next slide is just a screenshot of where you can go to find this Google Earth interactive mapping tool, as well as 107 Energy Interactive Map. If you click on that, you got Google Earth loaded onto your computer, you're pretty much set and ready to go. It'll launch it. And if you scroll two more slides, these are out of order, you'll see the map of the United States, which with a bunch of dots on it. And it all of these dots denote the colors. Yellow are abandoned mine lands, the kind of pink or what looks purple on my screen are the brownfield sites. Red are RCRA. Pink, really pink, are the federal Superfund. And then there's a gray that are the non-federal Superfund sites. And if you scroll back one slide, I just pulled out some examples of what it looks like when you actually click on the dot that is the site. You will get a pop-up window that looks like this. And this just happens to be the Anaconda Mineral Company. And you'll see everything, the information about the site, including its name, its location. This, for some reason, says unknown in terms of mapped acreage, but most of these will actually have the acres shown as well, the type of land, the region that it's in, the identifier. And then there are some links, and the first link that you see is an EPA cleanup program information, and that, if you click on that, that will open up a screen probably right below this map. And
the next one will go to the better time to stop here. She'll be on.
Sorry, somebody needs to mute. And It will take you to the EPA-maintained webpage for that site, so it gives you all of the environmental information on the site, contact information for people at the agency or the property, so you can call and inquire further on site-specific details. And then the middle section here, starting with renewable energy potential, gives all of the, it outlines qualitative and quantitatively the renewable energy generation potential at the site as we have screened it. So it goes through the wind, the solar, non-grid, here in this case it shows non-grid photovoltaics, as well as the biomass, biorefining resource potential. And then there's a another link under the site-specific renewable energy data that we actually get a lot of requests for. That is the actual raw data that we used to input into the GIS system that created this mapping application. And it's basically in an Excel spreadsheet. It's very large, but the reason why we provided it is so that folks who are interested can actually work with the data themselves. And this is all publicly available information, which is brought together in one place. And then we have our data methodology and data and methodology description, which is basically just that. It's our data guidelines that tells you how we did everything, all of the methodology, all the data sources, the screening criteria, the limitations of the data, and things of that nature. And then if you want to just go straight to the static maps themselves, you can, for each state, or second to the last link, the U.S., to take you right to those incentive sheets and maps. And then we have our general at the bottom there under contact. So scrolling two more slides, I just pulled up a couple. And you can see over on this one's the Longhorn Army Ammunition Plant in Texas. And you can see over on the left-hand side different types of renewable energy that are checked. And those should come up automatically checked when you load it for the first time as a default. So you'll see everything. But if you wanted to just screen out for just utility scale wind, you could just unclick all of those boxes, and you'll be left with all the sites in the United States that have utility wind, for example. And you can also sort through these types of renewable energy as well as by state and by site, if you would like, using the Excel spreadsheet that's attached, renewable energy Excel spreadsheet. And the next slide is just another example. I'm not going to go into the details, as well as the next one, the Lee's Acre landfill. Just really quickly wanted to go over the utility scale solar and wind potential. This is something that we've looked at, and I just think it's an important thing to note. This is looking at all of our sites and where they're located, and we found that about a little over 5 million of the acres of EPA track lands are located in areas of potential. So that's mostly in the southwest region of the country. If we redeveloped, reused all these properties and redeveloped them with utility scale PV and CSP, concentrated solar power, what would we get? And we found that it would yield an electricity capacity of 919,000 megawatts and a greenhouse gas emission reduction of approximately over 2,000 million metric tons of carbon equivalent. So, and we did the same with the highest wind resources for our sites, and approximately 580,000 acres of EPA track land showed up in this area, these areas. And the corresponding capacity developed, were we to do utility and community scale, was about 17,000 megawatts and a 39 million metric ton greenhouse gas equivalent, CO2 equivalent reduction. The next slide is just to show you very quickly what's on the incentive sheets. It covers for every state all of the state-level grants and loan programs, any kind of net metering programs that are offered, other incentives such as equipment loan programs for example, for wind production, if you want to do wind, some states will actually rent out or lend anemometers, so you could actually test out the wind at the site. Tax abatements, deductions and credits, and the federal incentives, which just changed, were just extended this year through the economic stimulus package. And also just wanted to point your attention to the database of state incentives and renewable energy and energy efficiency. You can find all of these incentives at that location on that DSIRUSA.org. We have pulled them all together, the next slide, into these incentive sheets that we are updating regularly. This one just happens to be for New Mexico. It shows the tax incentives, the technical assistance, and other incentives, the net metering. And then there are some quick facts and points of contact within the state for each of these programs, so you can call them or email them directly. On the back side of this incentive sheet, you'll see the incentives for development of contaminated land. So this is a lot of the technical assistance, the brownfields grants, the brownfields cleanup and revolving loan funds and things of that nature. And again, the quick facts about the state in terms of limitations on liability, number of sites within the state, brownfields properties, et cetera, and then the points of contact. The next slide, just going to go very quickly because I think I'm running over on time, are some of the successes. This one is touted a lot. This is the Bethlehem Steel site. It's in Lackawanna, New York. They have currently 8 wind turbines. They're going to expand it to 18, so they're going to add 10 more. This is a old contaminated site that was lying empty pretty much for years. And the company went in and worked with the state and with EPA to get through 8 turbines of approximately 20 megawatt generation capacity would get power from that facility. And domestically manufactured wind turbines in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. So again, getting back to the kind of the green job creation, and then of course there are local O&M facility maintenance jobs that are created by projects like this. This next site is the Fort Carson, Colorado site. It's an old landfill, and decided to put a solar array on, and it's a 2-megawatt solar array. A 12-acre landfill, 3,200 megawatt hours of electricity. They got a really good production rate, a fixed rate of 5.5 cents per kilowatt hour over the 17-year contract. And they estimate, last I checked, about $500,000 savings over the life of the contract. This next site is the Summitville Mine site in Colorado, another one that's a great success story. This is using the microhydro electric turbines to power the on-site treatment plant that treats acid mine drainage. It is, it's going to generate 250,000 to 290,000 kilowatt hours per year. It's about 25 households. And will prevent 250 to 275 metric tons of CO2. But they're going to use this energy to actually power the system. So this is a great example of green remediation in progress. They estimate that there will the energy from this system will provide 100% of the needs for the remediation system, which is fantastic. And the next one is a brownfield site, the petroleum brownfield site, a sequential biofuel station. Really neat site. They a green roof, you can see that in the background, a convenience store roof. There's 244 solar panels on the island, fueling stations, providing 30 to 50% of the power for the station, which is great. And the next slide is the Holmes Road landfill. It's a proposed solar field in Houston, Texas. It's a 300-acre former landfill. It's very close to downtown. And the city applied for some funds through the Brownfields program and was awarded a $50,000 grant to assess the solar energy production there on that former landfill. And they're using that to evaluate a variety of environmental kind of engineering regulatory issues involved in the project. And they're also going to do an energy production and financial feasibility study there. So some of the next steps, and I'm going to wrap it up. The mapping tool, we're working on trying to find the best ways to add state sites, because the sites that are included in the Google Earth map renewable energy mapping tool are just EPA track sites, so don't include the state sites. So we're working on that. We're evaluating whether or not to look at to include landfill methane, so identifying the methane-producing landfills and incorporating those in our analysis, as well as coal bed methane, possibly. And we're also looking into something that is a big issue for any kind of renewable energy development, and that is the actual transmission capacity, where there are kind of congestion, where there's congestion in the transmission infrastructure, and identifying where those locations are, because that will determine whether or not a renewable energy project that will go into the grid is feasible. And partnerships, we're just continuing to develop key partnerships with federal and state organizations and private parties as well, private entities. And some of the resources, I just point this out in a lot of my talks, are the Brownfield funds, of course. We have the Office of Solid Waste Emergency Response is the office I work in. We are just about finishing up an interagency agreement with the National Renewable Energy Lab, where we will provide financial support for their expertise to help us with some of our sites, our EPA sites, to redevelop with renewable energy, so feasibility studies and things of that nature. We're going to continue to work on documenting ongoing and future successes. We actually have some success story fact sheets that will be coming out fairly shortly here, and will be put up on the website, which I'll give you in a second. And we're also working on some technical and regulatory guide to siting renewable energies on contaminated lands and mining sites. And so, next slide, the contracting toolkit. I just want to give you some of the contact names here. Their primary contact is Carlos Pachon. He's done a fantastic job of leading the green remediation work for EPA headquarters here. His contact information is there. Mine is right below his if you can't get in touch with him or you have other questions. For the renewable energy development, you can call me, send me an email. You can also go to the cleanenergy@epa.gov website at the bottom of the slide. And Steve Hoffman is now a partner with me on this, so his contact information is there as well. And the next slide is the renewable energy website, where you can find the Google Earth mapping tool, as well as the static maps, incentive sheets, the liability relief tools as well, and the website or email address again. And that's it. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Penny. And we have time for just a couple of questions. I will read one which came through online, and then I'll open it up to the phone folks for one question. The one that came online was, Penny, you stated that cleanup goals have been achieved and control long-term protection for the sites that will house renewable energy facilities. What type of cleanup goals, residential, commercial, industrial, or even higher soil standards are due to lower human exposure and use? And what controls are typically required?
I hope I understand the question correctly. The first goal of any of these sites is to make sure they're cleaned up to the standards that are set for the site. And to the extent that renewable energy can be developed on those sites after they're cleaned up or while they're being cleaned up, as in the examples of using it to help with the remediation, that's kind of how we're working this into the site process, if that makes sense. The site does, so in other words, we wouldn't be developing something that on a site, once it's cleaned up, if there that wasn't appropriate for an end use, for example. I hope that answers the question, Raji.
If not, they can email you or follow up with you.
Great.
And I will open it up for one question via phone lines if anybody has a question.
I have a question regarding whether you could incorporate into the tool some kind of a spreadsheet that would allow to do the economic analysis and be able to calculate payback periods based on, let's say, panel costs and energy costs at those particular locations.
Yeah, that would be fantastic to be able to do that for every site. I don't think we can do it for all sites. It would be so high level, I don't know how meaningful it would be. But we could certainly provide references to calculators that could help with return on investment calculations for a given site. But that's so site specific that I'm not sure if the kind of analysis that we could do would be that useful, because it would be very high level. But that being said, as I mentioned at the beginning of the call, we are working on cost-benefit analysis of looking at developing these brownfields, if you will, contaminated lands and mining sites versus greenfields. So I know that doesn't directly answer your question, but we are looking at the kind of costs from that perspective on a larger scale. But I'll take note of that for sure. I have actually taken note of that from a past call and presentation where we had very similar interests. So we're looking at kind of what can we provide for folks that would be useful and representative of what they might see in terms of return on investment for a development.
I have a follow-up.
Okay.
I was just curious if any of the sites or anyone is looking at cashing in on some of the voluntary offset market that's developed, selling whatever is produced by the renewable energy into these programs, into these voluntary offset programs.
Are you talking about carbon offset programs? Greenhouse gas?
Yeah, the voluntary ones that are out there, actually doing pretty well.
Like Chicago Climate Exchange, that sort of thing?
Well, there's a lot of local programs in different states, like ski areas will get their users to buy, to fund renewable energy projects. Airlines do it.
Yeah.
Different companies that rent cars.
And
offsets are sold for, concerts and conferences.
Right. So we haven't really looked at that as to include in this tool, but that's certainly something that, say, for example, a company who is responsible for contamination at a site wants to come in and redevelop their site with renewable energy. That's something that they could certainly try to take advantage of. I think that's a great point and something that's very important to bring up. And I can only imagine that if a company is looking seriously at this as an option, that they are considering that in their kind of their financial evaluation.
Thank you, Penny. And if you're going to stick around, there's more time in the end.
Great.
And now we'll move on to our second speaker. Our second speaker is Rosemary Caraway. Rosemary Caraway has worked as a remedial project manager for over 19 years in the San Francisco Superfund Division. She has a Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry from Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and an MBA from Golden Gate University in San Francisco, California. She has constructed remedies at 8 Superfund sites, and her experience includes in situ and ex situ soil stabilization and biotreatment, landfill caps, temporary and permanent relocations, groundwater pump and treat systems, and innovative technologies such as phytoremediation and electrical resistive heating. Welcome, Rosemary.
Hey, good morning, everybody, or good afternoon for those of you on the West Coast. Can you hear me okay? I'm going to go ahead and move to my second slide. I'm going to talk to you about the Pemaco Superfund site. It's located about 10 minutes south of Los Angeles, and it's in Maywood, California. It's a 1.4-acre site. It's a former chemical or custom blending chemical company, and they operated between 1950 and 1991, in general, and above-ground storage tanks, which actually leaked into the aquifer. EPA did a removal in 1997 where we took out some of those underground storage tanks, and then we installed a soil vapor extraction system within the tank farm area. And then we moved into the RI process, if you go to the next slide, so that we can actually look at what was beneath the tanks. So we found soil and groundwater contained some of our highest concentration in the subsurface, about 30. In 2005, we signed a ROD. The ROD is for a vapor and groundwater pump and treat system with electrical resistive heating in the main source area. And then we have an enhanced in-situ bioremediation as part of that, and it's a standalone for the dissolved phase plume and a polish for the source zone if we need it after we do the ERH treatment. So we started construction on this site. This next slide is the slide of the removal, which shows the tank farm, which is how big those tanks were. They were about 15 gallons in terms of what they were holding. And then the next slide, in terms of activities, we did the RI in 2004. We started our public comment, and it ended up being a long one between April and September of 2004, and we signed the ROD in 2005. So we started construction in a kind of a phased approach. This project also has, as part of its process, we were working with the Pemaco property was to be a park. So in 2005, we started construction because the city had a deadline for when they needed park construction to be completed, because they had to spend the money based upon state parameters. So we started with the vapor and groundwater well installation, and then we installed conveyance piping to the treatment plant. We also moved the treatment plant away from the former site and put it on the edges of what would be park land. In 2006, we designed the electrical resistive heating system and worked on the construction of the treatment plant, and then we put in the electrodes and the temperature monitoring well locations for monitoring the temperature within the source zone. So this next slide is just kind of an overview of the site. If you look on the left-hand side, you can see it's bounded by Alamo Avenue and 59th Place. The ERH area is on the right-hand side, and we have the former Pemaco site boundary kind of outlined. And then you can see the park or where the park is. Where the ERH area is located, when we're done in this area, sometime in the next year or two, we'll go back to the city, and then they will finish their park construction. The native stockpile, if you see in the lower left-hand corner, is their soil. So when we're done and give the land back to them, they can finish construction. And our treatment plant is in the lower right-hand corner. Again, this site is located in L.A. It's a very dense area of L.A., and it's with residential housing across the street. The park was completed in June of 2006. In February of 2007, we did an enhanced in-situ biofield pilot, and then in April of 2007, we turned on the groundwater treatment system, and the next month, we turned on the vapor treatment system. September of 2007, we turned on the electrical, and then last year in April, after 200 days of heating, we were able to actually turn that achieved cleanup numbers where we went from 22,000 ppb down to certainly less than 500. Some areas are less than 100, just depending on what areas you're looking at. In October of 2008, we actually sampled what we call the hot spots. We went back into the source area. Oh, I'm sorry. Somebody told me I'm forgetting to say next slide. So we're at October 2008, we sampled the hot soils in the ERH well field. And so we have post-treatment sampling results that are actually coming in. I think they've started coming in already, and we're putting them in the database. And I'm going to the next slide. So the slide that I'm on right now is our groundwater plume when we started out at the RI phase. So it shows the Pemaco site boundary. Again, it shows you the 10,000 ppb area, our source 10,000 ppb. The next slide shows the dimensions of the treatment building. So I started out with this process. We were actually in construction, had started putting our piping in the ground, and Penny sits near me and was working on green remediation and asked if I could consider implementing anything at Pemaco. And at that particular time, we had already moved soil and so forth, and the building was beginning to go up. And so what we were able to do was talk to the builder, and they were able to order makes a little bit of changes in the roofing so that we can handle the load of solar panels. So this particular treatment building is actually south-facing. It's a steel roof. It's a steel building. It's 81 feet long by 27 feet wide, and the top of the ridge there is about 20 feet high. And the collateral load for the solar panels is about 4 pounds per square foot. So we put on the site about 20 solar panels. When you're looking at, I guess there are a couple things I want to talk about in terms of solar panels. For instance, you need to look at your particular community and what you're living in. For those of you who are doing this in some of the communities, for those of you who are doing it in more industrial settings, then you'll have an easier time implementing it and can do more of an industrial type solar panel install. But in general, for your system design, and I'm on the slide that says system design, you need to carefully inventory all the electrical equipment in your facility. You need to determine the power consumption of that equipment and then their hourly usage within a 24-hour period. And then you want to size your photovoltaic system so that it'll match that energy usage. And you want to do that based on the number of peak sun hours that you have per day. And then I have a reference there for CalSolarEng in terms of they have a really extensive explanation of looking at system design. For the Pemaco site, we installed a 3.4 kilowatt photovoltaic system on July 3rd, or turned it on July 3rd of 2007. It produces about 5,600 kilowatt hours per year. That was from our specs. We're offsetting about 3.3 tons of carbon dioxide per year and 2.5 acres of trees and 7,600 car miles. I think what I wanted to talk, maybe I should talk to you guys a little bit about in terms of putting it up, the contracting side of this became really interesting for me. This site is a fund lead site, and we were working with the Army Corps of Engineers. And again, we hadn't planned for this particular expenditure, so I had lots of discussions with my contracting group trying to convince them, and eventually they listened, that we should go ahead and order this thing. This particular system, though, will be good for folks if you wanted to direct people here. This is a typical system that you would actually put on a home. And it's generating probably, if you have the same sun hours, about what you would find, especially typically in California, if you put the system on your home. So we're looking at an actually a homeowner system, kind of on an industrial building. The other reason we went this route is that we couldn't make major changes to the equipment or the order that we did for the roofing, and a lot of our electrical piping and so forth runs and it's hanging from the roof on the inside of the what kind of weight I put on the outside. So we had two sets of mounting tracks on the south-facing roof. That was the next slide for installation. The next slide, it took 4 days to install, and we had, again, like I said, 20 solar panels, and this picture is just showing you what the solar panels looked like before they went up on the roof and the panel roof. The next slide, it's part of that installation. We actually talked about making sure that the question was, what were we going to do with the energy? And so we looked at making sure that we had a battery-powered backup for our computers. Our system is actually computerized, or the treatment plant equipment is computerized on the inside. And so we wanted to make sure if there was any kind of power outage that we had a battery backup. So the system is set up so that we make sure that that battery is always, if you will, charged. And so in the event of a power shortage. With the power shortage, I mean, what the backup power battery backup allows us to do is we can remotely turn off the system. So if the battery backup occurs, we can also do a follow-through in terms of making sure the system shuts down correctly. Next slide is I show a slide with the install complete. It's a picture of the treatment plant again with a gentleman in the front in a truck, if those of you who are trying to follow me on the slides. The next slide, I'm looking at the electrical control room. We have a number of parts that require, if you will, electricity within the treatment plant. So this is just showing the major control room electrical box in the front. On the left is the box for the actual solar system. And then the next slide shows you the electrical panel for the solar system. It's a Xantrax. It's a grid tie solar inverter system. On this particular system, we actually are generating or utilizing more power than we're generating. So all of our power actually goes directly to the equipment within the treatment plant, and then we just draw less power from the grid. And it's another slide that actually shows it too, which. Now, we have a couple of pieces of equipment that are used, our pumps that's actually utilizing the most power in our treatment plant. The next slide shows just an overview of the treatment plant. The stuff on the right-hand side of the slide, the pipes coming in are showing both the groundwater in the background and the vapor in the front of the slide. It's just showing how they're coming into the treatment plant. The next, I think there's two of those. Showing the groundwater treatment system, the carbon canisters, both for groundwater on the left and for vapor on the right. And then I'm on a slide called energy usage. So this is just showing the energy used by the treatment plant between October of 2007. Remember, we turned on in April of 2007. In April of 2000, about 159,000 kilowatt hours, or averaging as high as 159,000 per month to as low as about 111,000 per month in March of last year. The second line just shows the number of days, and then the bottom one shows the average kilowatt hours used per day by the treatment plant. The cost of this particular system, next slide, was about $30,000. You can, if you're not a federal site, receive a $9,000 rebate for your system. For us, we actually have we're on a commercial rate in terms of the cost of our energy into the plant. On July 5th of 2008, operating, we had actually generated 6,172 kilowatt hours, or 514 kilowatt hours per month. I think over the year we were between 514 and 521 kilowatt hours per month in terms of what we averaged. I have our folks actually go and read the meter on the box weekly, so that we can keep track of how much energy we're actually generating on a weekly, or how the meter changes from week to week.
What they need.
It's a pretty small system, really.
Okay. Next slide. In terms of energy estimates, what I did here was I went for the energy, so we set up a contract with Southern California. And so the bills come to EPA, and then EPA actually pays the individual bill. So if I look at a typical a bill for about 5,440 kilowatt hours, we would actually pay Southern California almost $2,500. So that's kind of where our savings are, if you will, for the year. Again, if I did some other kind of math, I can generate for the year, we're looking at approximately 46 cents. We saved approximately anywhere between 20 at 6172. We saved about 2,800 for the year, and again, maybe about $236 per month in energy charges in terms of looking at where our savings are.
They're going to take to pay back for the system, though. So that's kind of 30, a false 000. Statement.
30 000.
Years. Yeah.
You mute. So I think when you're starting to look at the system, you're right, it can take a long time to actually the system when you're starting to look at our costs. The other thing, though, that I'm finding is that Southern California Edison, in terms of dealing with them, I may have some changes in some of these numbers just because the last month they were charging us for energy when we had turned systems off. So what that means is I have to decide how the heck I'm going to audit them for the energy we used for the last year. And my newest bill, we have a treatment running, and the amount of kilowatt hours we were actually using for the month is typically over 100,000, and the newest bill is at 54,000. So, I mean, I think we may have some issues. So my recommendation to you guys, if you're thinking about installing this, if there is some way you can put your own meters on your system, you really need to invest in that kind of a process. Because if I'm running my system 24 hours a day and I'm using the same amount of equipment and all of it's running and my electricity just dropped in half, and it's just turning out to be a real interesting dilemma in terms of how do you approach a utility company. And I'm telling you, they're a royal pain just in general. In terms of the lesson learned, the key thing is if you have an opportunity and you're going to put it on a building, you want to do the placement. You want to look at your building placement and roof alignment, because maybe you'll get a better draw, if you will, on your electricity. You're out of the panels on the roof, and you want to minimize shadowing, so you don't want to have shadows from other buildings kind of being cast on your panels. Again, this is just looking at, I left those two numbers up because I did some slides for NARPM, and so for NARPM I had the generation between June 21st of 2008, and I just added between June and July 5th of 2008, which is kind of the year. So we went over we went slightly over our estimates in terms of what we generated. The system was supposed to generate about 5,500, and we're probably closer to 6,000 in terms of what we're actually generating by the panels. Again, this is just showing the average uses of electricity inside the treatment plant according to the bills that we've already paid. So that's about $126,000. And then you want to check your eligibility of your solar system for state-sponsored rebates. And then my last slide, I thought I would just give you a pictorial of how site security can affect your decision on what type of system you actually install. One of the things I was actually thinking about doing was installing actually some sort of a ground system in front of the building. And I guess it's a good thing that I didn't. This is the third time we've replaced this gate, and we're working on the second time in the last 3 months. So for some reason, I think I have NASCAR drivers out in Maywood, and they think it's a blast to actually run their car through a wrought iron gate. They leave the car and run off, come get the car, and then we have to figure out how to get insurance money back. So this is just a typical Maywood, if you will, incident. Like I said, it's the third time. So I guess we're, quote, right now self-insured. So anyway, if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Rosemary. Yeah, we'll open it up for questions. And I have one online question, and then we'll open it up to the phone lines. And the question online is, did you use the solar power to charge and recharge your battery backup system?
Yes, we did. But it also goes into the main, it's going into the main system, though. Going for the battery, but it's also, there's leftover energy, so it's actually being used by the building, by the equipment in the building.
Any phone questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Go ahead.
I was curious as to what amount of transmission losses you observed during, like, from the solar, from the electricity generated from this solar system you had in place.
I don't think we've looked at whether or not we've had any losses.
Okay.
Rosemary, two-part question.
First,
I'm just curious how many gallons per minute the treatment plant was pumping, and then secondly, have you investigated the application of this further north in your state?
Hey, can you, it's running about 50 gallons per minute. Can you tell me what was your second question? Can you repeat it?
What'd you say? I didn't hear your response. You said six?
No, I said 50 gallons per minute.
Okay. And if you've investigated trying to use a solar application at any sites further north in your state, in California?
Yeah. There's another site in Davis, California, that actually put solar panels up. And they actually have more solar panels on their roof. Frontier Fertilizer, actually, is our other site in Region 9 that has solar panels.
Okay. Thank you.
Rosemary?
No, they actually get more. Davis is about the same. Davis is about, yeah, about the same. Yes?
There's a question online, and it says, can you use adjustable slopes for the panels to optimize solar exposure?
When we talked to the contractor, we were talking about actually trying to pin those to the roof, but the guys were really freaked out over whether or not we could actually carry that load. They didn't want to actually go through, because we didn't design this roof for the panels. We just added them towards the end. So I think you can do that as part of your, if you're talking to your contractor before you install it, but you really need to make sure your roof load and that you can penetrate some of those trusses in a manner so that those things can be shifted. But we didn't design, I mean, we put them on based upon where we're going to get the max energy based upon the building that we had. And I had talked about actually attaching them in a way so that we could tilt them. And that's what became a problem for us, just in terms of penetrations through those trusses.
Okay, thank you. I have another online question, and then I'll open it to one more phone line question. On slide 66, which costs slash income applies to monthly charges versus generation, and which are daily and yearly?
Okay, because I only have my slide, so the 60, that's an online question?
Yes. I'll get you this question.
Did they say energy usage slide? Is that the one? Can you repeat the question for me, please?
It's in the lessons learned. Slide 66 says lessons learned. And, okay, I'll repeat the question. The question says, which cost slash income applies to monthly charges versus generation, and which are daily and yearly?
Okay, so if you're looking at the kilowatt hours, the 5440 is just at a particular point in time. We had generated 55,440 kilowatt hours of energy. And when I went to a bill, if you will, that particular amount of energy cost us, or would have cost us, $2,497. And the same thing for the... and then what I did was at 40, I averaged out or did a multiplication, if you will, and at 46 cents, I just estimated that we're probably saving about $2,800 for the year. I'm not sure. If they still have questions, please just have them call me.
Yes, or they can email you or call you. It says the slide is energy estimates slides. So I think the slide number is a little bit off from what you're seeing.
Oh, that's the one. That's the one I was looking at. I actually, because of this, because EPA is paying the bill. So if anybody wants to look at it, I know a question was asked earlier in terms of trying to figure out cost benefit analysis. I actually have all the bills, both on this side and on the ERH side of the house, in terms of, because right now I'm just telling you what the costs are to run the treatment plant. So one of my goals in the next year when I find some time is to actually sit down and try to figure out or work on that cost-benefit analysis, but I want to make sure I take some time to do it because it gets a little confusing, because I'd have to go from my bills, and then on top of that, Southern California Edison changes its, they change which rate category they put us in depending on the time of the year. We also have some taxes that other people may not have, so I'm not sure if I should leave them in or maybe take them out. So there's a couple of things that I need to do so that people can actually understand the cost. So what I gave you on the slide that has the energy usage is just a plot from one of the bills that just shows you the monthly kilowatts used for that particular month. What I didn't do at the bottom of that is just tell you how much we paid in energy for that particular month, but I have all of that.
Okay, thank you, Rosemary. We'll open it for one question from the phones. Anybody has a question?
Yeah, I have a question. I'm a little confused about how you're metering the electricity. You do not have a meter, 2 meters? You're not metering your net production, and then...
No, we are metering it. We are metering it. The reason why I can give you the information is because that we can go to our panel and actually look at what we're generating and what's being metered.
And then do you have a meter that runs both ways for the utility?
If I needed to go the other way, I can, but we won't ever go the other way on this particular project. We're always, as long as I'm running that big old horsepower pump that I showed you in the picture, there's no way we'd be over what we generate for the month.
Well, then I don't understand, why do you need backup batteries?
Backup battery is for the computer system. It's just for the computer itself.
But if you're net metering in, wouldn't you always be under power?
No, I'm always overpowered. There's a battery on the computer.
Buying electricity, right?
I'm sorry?
You're always buying electricity, right?
Yes.
So wouldn't your computer run regardless of your solar panel performance?
True, it would, but if we had an emergency, then the computer, we don't lose the rights to the computer, and we can power it back up remotely.
Okay, so the battery has nothing to do with your solar installation.
No, it's just a secondary precaution, if you will, for the treatment plant.
Okay, I was just confused. I thought for some reason you were storing your solar power in the batteries.
No, we had talked about doing that, but because we were utilizing so much more, we're not. But it just makes sure that our battery is definitely powered and charged.
Okay,
so it's minimal is going to the battery. Most of it's going to the electricity that we're using in the plant. So we're utilizing all of it that we generate in the plant.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Before we move on to our next speaker, it's a question just open to anybody or everybody. It's a question that came online, and it says, does anyone have any info on durability of solar panels in severe weather like hail, high winds, etc.? And Rosemary, do you have an answer to that? Otherwise, I'll give the email address to everybody. Whoever is interested can email this person.
I'm sorry, Southern California, the only thing I'm worried about is an earthquake.
Okay.
Can we survive
so
those?
If anybody has an answer, please respond to Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y, .Dixon, D-I-X-O-N, @ D-E-Q, .OK, .GOV. And once again, I'll repeat the question. Does anyone have info on durability of solar panels in severe weather like hail, high winds, etc.? And if anybody has an answer, please send it to kelly.dixon @ deq.ok.gov. Thanks a lot, Rosemary. And we will move on to our third speaker. And before we move on, I would like to remind everybody, please put your phones on mute. And if you do not have a mute button, please hit *6. Thank you. Our third speaker is David Drake. David Drake is a remedial project manager at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Region 7 in Kansas City, Kansas. He received a B.S. in geology from Indiana University in 1984 and an M.S. in urban environmental geology from the University of Missouri, Kansas City in 1999. He's currently a doctoral candidate in geosciences public administration at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Mr. Drake worked as a geologist at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Kansas City District, for approximately 7 years prior to joining the EPA in 1993. He holds professional and registered geologist licenses, PG and RG, in the states of Tennessee and Missouri, respectively, and is a member of the Geological Society of America, the Association of Missouri Geologists, and the Association of Engineering Geologists. Welcome, David.
Oh, thanks, Raji. Thanks to everyone who has hung on to the bitter end also. I think we're at the last presentation today. So why don't we, let's move on to the first slide, the project overview slide. What we did, in general, we installed a wind turbine at a former Department of Defense site up in Nebraska. And we were very lucky. We pursued some OSWER Innovations Initiative funding on EPA's side, so we received about $75,000 from that program, and we also had a lot of partnering. The Army was interested in partnering with us because this was a former DOD site. We also had some interest from the University of Missouri, more on the research side of it, and the wind turbine manufacturer, Berge Wind Systems, also provided some support and in-kind services. So I think we had a good group of people. It was a diverse group of people, and I think overall that really made the project much better in the long run. Let's go ahead and move to the next slide on the study goals. You know, basically, as you can guess, our main goal was to reduce the power requirements for the pump and treat well where we had the wind turbine installed. And we did some other metrics. There are some other things we calculated, such as mass of VOCs removed. We also calculated some other things, you know, some offsets, emissions offsets, and other things like that. But basically, we were really trying to reduce the power requirements. That was the main goal of the system. Why don't we move on to the next slide. We installed a 10-kilowatt turbine. It's on about a 100-foot tower, and it's hooked up to a single groundwater circulation well. I guess I should explain a little about the well network at this site. There are 10 or 12 separate groundwater circulation wells. These are single pump and treat wells. They're really designed for mass removal, and they also feed into a very large treatment system that also, you know, treats water from a very standard system with a large number of wells. So anyway, these isolated GCW wells, you know, they were an optimum test case for us to go to one of these systems and do an alternative energy demonstration, and that was really our goal. Let's move on to the next slide. This is just really a schematic of the system. We had a grid intertie system on the wind turbine. And essentially what that is, I know we've talked a little bit about that in the prior two talks, but in times when the wind turbine is generating all the power that we need to operate the system, you know, it wholly powers the system. But in times when the wind is not as robust as we would like, the standard utility system will kick in and you know, provide the makeup power. So it's this oscillating of power between the grid and the wind turbine itself. Now, a bad aspect of doing this in Nebraska is there's really no net metering in Nebraska. So any overproduction that we may have from the system, we don't receive any credit from it at all. In other words, we're just putting power back into the grid, and we're not really being compensated for that. So that's kind of a key thing to look at when people from different regions are looking at different states and, you know, thinking about doing this technology, because that's a major aspect to consider. Let's move on to the next slide. I think we've talked about a lot of these bullets here. One thing we thought about when we were doing this project is we wanted to develop ideas for future study. We knew that this was our first attempt at looking at this type of approach, but a couple of ideas we had, and I'll cut to the chase on a couple of topics. I think getting away from the net metering and perhaps having a battery backup system, you know, in hindsight would have saved quite a bit of energy doing a situation like that. just in hindsight. And we may, you know, we have proposals out to enhance the system and carry, you know, carry it on into the future. And that's one thing that we're looking at. You see there the second bullet. There's a lot of agriculture in this area of Nebraska that we were working in. The big regional aquifer in that area, is, as many of you may know, is declining. So there's quite an interest in saving water. So this single well also conserved water. It's really somewhat of a closed-loop system where water is extracted from one portion of the aquifer, airstripped, and then re-injected back through the same well. So there's very little water loss. That was an important aspect to the project. Let's go on to the next slide. There's a schematic of the treatment system in general. Very briefly, you can see the cone of depression, the water being extracted. There's a below-grade stripper. Then the water is re-injected at a lower level in the aquifer. And as I mentioned, there are a few of these systems at the Superfund site, you know, mainly targeted towards mass removal. And so we chose an existing system like this to convert it over to wind power in order to do our evaluation test. Let's go on to the next slide. Why did we choose this spot? In general, the Great Plains are a great area for wind power, wind turbines. The wind conditions are very, very favorable. These large, there are many large pump and treat sites up in this area. There was a lot of historic, but mostly Department of Defense activities, a lot of very large munitions plants, a lot of activity has gone on. So we had several sites to choose from, so this was really just a very good mix for us, combined with some strong interest from the Army. I'll have to say that DOD actually contributed a much greater amount of funding for this work than even EPA did. So they really came to the table and provided quite a bit of funding support for us. And then the wind turbine manufacturer, as I mentioned before, was very interested in this and provided some support too. So overall, it worked out you know, very well. It was a great meshing of different people, organizations, the site, everything really fit in quite nicely. Let's move on to the next slide. This is just the wind atlas of the country, much as the contour maps we are all familiar with, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, but the country is really gridded off and mapped in terms of wind intensity. You see the darker colors there are areas of greater promise for wind power. So you see in general, if you look at the center of the country, you know, we're here in Kansas, where the regional office is, just north of us, the, you know, Nebraska, the Dakotas, that general Great Plains, High Plains area is just an optimum spot for wind power. And let's move on to the next slide. You can see how all these areas are also gridded much more fine. And I'll go ahead and bring up another point that will come up later on. When we were first putting the study together, we were really trying to figure, you know, okay, what type of gain are we going to see? So we were trying to model and estimate and predict the amount of power we would produce and the amount of savings we would generate and everything like that. But you'll see later when I do a little summary of this, you know, the result of the study, the results were slightly less than our predicted predicted results. And I'll get to a couple of reasons why that occurred. But one reason is this map right here that we're looking at, you know, these projected wind intensities in different locations. When we actually set up a, you know, went to our site, actually set up our, you know, instrumentation and everything, our mean wind intensities were slightly less than predicted. So anyway, that had an effect, and I'll just, I think that's an important point for people looking at this to, you know, take all of this with a grain of salt. You know, every contour map, all of these maps that really show intensities and information, I mean, they're fairly accurate, you know, but they really need to be ground truth at a much finer level. And that did play a small role in the results that we saw. Let's go ahead and move on to the next slide. These are just some energy facts. I know we've all been talking about alternative energy today and also during at NARPM, you know, during the long session. But I think most of us realize wind energy is going to be a very popular thing of the future. I mean, many, many applications of wind power are emerging. I think at NARPM I had mentioned a recent article I saw where many large airports are now putting in banks of wind turbines. There are banks of turbines in Boston at Logan Airport now, supplying quite a bit of power to the airport. Some other big airports are you know, going to copy that scenario. Many buildings, skyscrapers are incorporating small turbines on the roofs of the buildings to generate power. I mean, just in general, it's a, as we all know, is a big and up-and-coming topic. And you can see how the, you know, the velocity really does matter. These high wind areas really produce a lot more power. So that is, you know, a key thing in citing these things. Let's move on to the next slide. I won't talk much about this. These are just some details about the site, the former Nebraska Ordnance plant site. And I'll mention I'm not the RPM for this project either. My colleague here in Region 7, Scott Marcus, is actually the RPM for the overall project. I'm mainly just involved in this alternative energy study and aspects being conducted at the project. But as you can see, as I've discussed in the prior few slides, it has been an optimum place to do our study. Let's move on to the next slide. This is just a little finer location of where the site is. Let's go ahead and move on to the next one. Again, I won't spend a lot of time on this either, just some facts about the groundwater and various plumes in the geologic system at the site. Again, all very amenable to pump and treat, very amenable to doing these types of studies, and I would also say very amenable to incorporating alternative energy in the future. You know, much, much greater applications than our small test turbine that we installed. I mean, I think there's opportunity to do much, much more of this, in addition to solar and other things as well at these large projects. Now let's move on to the next slide. As I mentioned before, these GCWs are just single well systems. They're 12-inch wells. This particular one was a 50 GPM well, and you can see the annual power usage of 28,000 kilowatt hours. Now, basically, we looked at the power requirements of everything in the system. You know, we have a submersible pump which extracts the water, you know, brings it up to the stripper. We have a big blower motor on the stripper, which by the way, takes well over 50% of the power for this system. Then the water, as I mentioned before, is just re-injected through the same well to a lower point in the aquifer. And because it's in Nebraska, even though the design of the stripper was subgrade to assist with the heating, you know, preventing the water from freezing, there's occasionally the need for a space heater, electrical tape, things like that to keep the system from freezing up. So what we were doing, you know, we're looking at all the power requirements of everything at this system. That was really another part of our study. And I'll go ahead and mention something that's really not on the slide. This is related to some of our future, you know, possible future directions that we may go. I had mentioned we were thinking about taking the system off the grid, in other words, doing away with the grid intertie setup and just having a battery backup system. We've also been looking at the idea of putting in an in-situ PRB, like a permeable reactive barrier cell that the water could trickle through, and then that would extract the contaminants, and then we would essentially do away with the subgrade stripper, which, as I mentioned before, uses quite a bit of power. We feel that, I guess, for the next phase of this project, a system like that could be totally energy efficient. So I think one thing that's resulted from the study, you know, we've gotten a lot of good ideas of other things to try, other things to experiment with, but I think the key is to keep producing more power and trying to reduce the power demand in any way that we can, and I think that will net the best outcome overall. Now let's move to the next slide, which is kind of a great summary of everything. You see that we had estimated about 36% of the power demand would be met by this system, and you know our results came out about 10% lower than we thought. And as I mentioned before, the wind intensity was much well, not much, but was somewhat less than predicted before we constructed this system. Another thing we found, and this is something to keep in mind, when we did our estimates, you know, we were sizing and specking out various types of turbines and systems, you know, trying to come up with a cost, you know, cost-effective design. So we thought we did that, and we purchased this, you know, 10-kilowatt turbine from Berge Wind Systems. But when we received the turbine, the actual foils, the blades on this turbine, were the old design blade. So all of our calculations were based on a very new model blade that was not yet quite available, but was advertised. So we were, you know, doing calculations on a set of blades that were much more efficient than the ones actually on the model that we purchased. So that you know, also resulted in producing a little less power than we suspected. So as you can guess, that all that translates into less savings, you know, and increasing the payback time of the system. Our capital cost were about $38,000. We had expected about an approximate 50 year payoff period, and you can see that number really goes up when the performance and efficiency is not, you know, quite what was expected. But I think another thought I'll throw in here that's really not on the slide, and this is in terms of lessons learned and future ideas for study. We've also kicked around the idea of over-designing a turbine. In other words, you know, taking this system here and you know, putting a much greater kilowatt capacity turbine than needed, with the intent of overproducing power and then receiving money back through a net metering situation. Now, of course, this will not work in Nebraska, of course, but I think in other states or locations, that's also an idea that I think is well worth pursuing. You know, if you could get to a situation where you're actually generating a little income from the turbine, I mean, say you have a turbine where you're you know, you're meeting all your power demands, you're not on the grid, you're not dealing with the nightmare of the grid intertie, you're just off the grid, you have a battery backup, perhaps you have a PRB or some type of low power treatment system. You know, you could really start operating that type of system very, very efficiently, and then you could start making actually some income on the net metering aspects. Then that income could be used to help fund the O&M, to help pay salary, analytical costs for sampling, all kinds of benefits could come from a system like that. Let's move on to the next slide. I think this really illustrates the value of doing this in my mind. When we start looking at these gains, this 30-year environmental gains as just an example, but when you think about it, this is really a tiny little wind turbine. You know, a 10-kilowatt turbine, it's really not a monster turbine by any stretch of the imagination. It's a typical household type turbine. But over a 30-year period, I mean, it eliminates 169 tons of greenhouse gases, saves over $16,000 of savings. And that's and also look at that rate. That's at a very, very cheap rate. This particular spot that we're at in Nebraska, the power is it's inexpensive. You can see just raising that up to about 9 cents a kilowatt hour makes a big difference. So there again, people interested in doing this who are in states or geographic areas where the power is quite expensive, this payback is a really big deal. This number could escalate by quite a bit. You're in a situation where you pay a lot for power, and then again, as I just mentioned on the last slide, if you're lucky enough to be in a location where you have that situation and you have a very favorable net metering situation, you know, you can start running the numbers and you can you could design a project, I believe, that would be very, very inefficient, very, very efficient. Now, we're getting towards the end. I have a few pictures to show. Let's move on to the first one. Here's just the tower laid out on the ground, getting ready to install the system. Let's go ahead and move to the next one. Just some routine work on the tower. Again, the wind manufacturer provided some in-kind help and services with us on this. Let's move on to the next one. You'll see the lights on the tower. We did have to coordinate with the Federal Aviation Administration. We had to work with them on the sizing and location and everything regarding these lights on the tower. That actually became more of a little more of a hassle than you might believe. A lot of paperwork, exchanging hands, and a lot of back and forth over something that you would think is a relatively minor aspect to this. But I guess if a plane flies into it, it's probably not a minor aspect to it. But anyway, that is one consideration of it. Let's just move on to the next one. This is just a great Nebraska photo for any corn huskers who may be on the call. Just a typical snow-covered tundra. Interesting, when we were installing this turbine, everyone was snowed in the hotel for a couple of days, so it protracted the erection of it, but we finally managed to get everything up and installed. Let's go on to the next slide. You can see there it's starting to take shape. There's the big body of the turbine itself. Let's move on to the next one. You can see the foils are starting to be installed. It's starting to really take shape. Let's go ahead and move on to the next one. That's now on the top of the tower. Go ahead and move on. You'll notice the big crane that had to be mobilized to the site to erect the turbine. Let's go ahead and move on to the next one. Corrected, you can see the people standing by it for scale. You can see a fairly complete view of it. Let's go ahead and move on to the next one. There are steel cables also need to be installed to hold it in place. That's what they're doing there. Let's move on to the next one. Again, that's just a nice shot of the fully constructed turbine with the wires in place. Let's move on to the next one. This is just a shot of the control panel, all the interior aspects of the grid intertie in the system. And let's move on to the next one. You can see the meters. I'll touch on, I may touch on a little something that Rosemarie brought up to, and I would agree with her that I did not find it very, very easy to work with the utility doing this. Just to, you know, help illustrate that, when we first constructed this turbine, you know, we were excited to see the power reductions and start looking at the data. In the first two or three months into the project, our bills were double the pre wind turbine amount, and it took, you know, quite a number of phone calls and visits and meetings to figure out we were being charged for all the power we were generating. So they were just billing us for everything. So there were tremendous metering problems and situations. There were different meters provided that had conversion formulas associated with them. In other words, you don't just read the meter, but you put that information into an equation to then come up with the actual value, you know, with no information to really discern or work that out. So we had quite a bit of a logistical nightmare just working with this intertie system and getting it all sorted out. It eventually was sorted out, but it was somewhat of a cumbersome project to deal with. Let's move on to the next slide. This is just a close-up of the cables and the bollards just protecting the turbine. We don't have the problem of people driving through this and vandalizing or anything, or vandalizing it like some urban sites. The biggest concern here is staying away from the crops, you know, not infringing on the agricultural areas. Let's move on to the next slide. This is just a close-up of the vault that holds the subgrade air stripper, just a shot of that. Again, looking at just, you know, when we're doing this, we're also trying to kick around just ways to be energy efficient, thermally efficient. We've added some insulation both on the side walls and top of this to help, you know, reduce the power requirements in that way, too. We're almost done. Let's move to the next slide. That's just a shot of the treatment, just the building, and you can see the stripper there to the right. And then the final slide is just a sunrise over the prairie with the turbine there in the foreground, and I guess I'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody may have. I think we have just a few minutes left here.
Thanks, David. Yes, we have a few minutes. I will open it up for one question from the phone line, and then I'll read off some from the online questions. So if anybody on the phone, please go ahead.
I have a question in regard to the variability which we experience with wind power. So when you design a system, what sort of alternatives you can plan on to counter this variability?
You mean the variability of the wind itself?
Yeah, like from year to year, you might not have the same intensity. So you plan for something much higher and you end up using much less of it, but some years you'll have more. So how, what sort of systems, if you have any idea, would help to go over that sort of variability?
I think you could probably look back. I don't know if there are historic records. Well, there are historic records, actually, because these, you know, these, as you probably know, these wind intensity atlases and maps are based upon a lot of weather station data and airport data that are collected in the various states, you know, and it's all compiled. You know, you could look at a historic, look at that and maybe start look, and, you know, you could maybe see, you know, what's the 10-year variability or the 20-year variability, depending on what your design life is for the system that you're putting up, then that might, you know, help you to size it and everything more accurately. And then again, you know, what I would do is I would err on the side of oversizing it. I mean, especially if net metering is favorable and you can, you know, receive credit or money back from the utility, providing it is on a, provided you do have it on a grid system. And when I'll just mention one other side, I mean, another thing we've thought about too, at it, you know, many of these pump and treat systems, you know, they're not always operating 100% of the time. You know, a lot of times they're down for maintenance, there are pump problems, you know, there's a whole host of things that stops an, you know, an actual system from really being fully operational, you know, 100% of the time every day. So we've also looked at the situation, well, what if we took it off the grid and it just didn't operate, or it operated less efficiently than expected. In other words, say we're targeting a 50 GPM rate and we really don't achieve that all the time, or we achieve that a lesser amount of time. Does that really matter, you know, in the whole scheme of things? So I would look at things like that as far as design and construction and design life and that historic data from the you know, airports and NOAA and places where we receive that information.
Thanks, David. On a related note, there's a question online. It says, is the turbine designed for tornado strength winds? If not, does insurance cover failure or collapse in very high winds or ice storms?
Okay, the turbine has a, it has a, what's called a self-furrowing device that's on it. In other words, when the wind intensity gets to a certain level, the turbine can sense that, and the tail folds in, and the turbine then will not operate. You know, it will shut itself down in order to preserve itself. So that's a design feature that's in that turbine, and that should, you know, protect it under you know, almost every high wind situation. Now, if an actual tornado or, you know, some very destructive, unusual storm event came through, well, then you're right. I mean, the whole thing could be destroyed. And I don't think, we did not, on this particular aspect, I'm not aware, or I don't think we have any type of insurance on it. But that's a very good question. It's a very good point to bring up, and actually that's a question or point I have not really thought about to date, but that's, you know, an excellent question. You know, if we had a big system or big banks of turbines, I mean, you would certainly want some type of insurance to protect them. But under normal, you know, very high wind situations, they are designed to not, you know, to furrow and not destroy themselves.
Okay, and I'll just have one last question before we sign off. And this question is actually coming to you from the Netherlands. It says, in the Netherlands, we also try to combine remediation projects with the use of thermal energy. In this way, we could save a lot of heating or cooling energy in above ground buildings. Is this something that has been done in the U.S. as well?
In general, I would say it's not being done in the U.S., but I also think that that's an excellent comment, and that is something that we should do much more of in this country. You know, we really don't do that to the degree that we should. You know, and you can look at many examples of Scandinavia as an example with building design, you know, just highly efficient designs of buildings and structures, and the comment from the Netherlands regarding the, you know, the subgrade or underground you know, design of remedial systems. That would be an excellent way to move forward, because it would save, you know, quite a number of resources, and I'm not aware that we're really doing that here at all. You know, in fact, a lot of times it's the converse. You know, a lot of I find in these, you know, in evaluating the O&M, you know, the long-term operation and maintenance of ongoing systems, I find there's often very, very little scrutiny or at all related to power consumption. You know, people just, you know, they'll turn up the heat rather than insulate, or, you know, or take design considerations to lessen the cost.
This is Penny McDaniel. Just to add to that, I failed to mention during my presentation that one of the next steps we're taking is to actually map out some of the low-grade and high-grade geothermal resources available. And again, it's a larger scale screening, but the idea and the hope is that it will be useful for folks to tap into the information when they're looking at, say, designing a remediation system, to tap into that kind of heat source to help. Okay. So that's coming down.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Penny, Rosemary, and David. And there were a few questions we could not get to that came online. And what I will do is I will send those to you along with the emails of those who asked the question, so then you can get back to them directly. So thanks thanks everybody for joining, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Raji.
Okay, thank you.